door for us. He's going to speak to us on the topic, Who Has Believed Our Report? Who has believed our report? Brother Ray.
I bring with you the loving greetings of your brethren a continent away in Jersey City. And they are sending you those greetings by virtue of their scriptural text, which reads as follows. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. 2 Corinthians 9:8. I know that all of you recognize the scripture from whence my title has been selected, the 53rd Psalm. Who hath believed our report? When our Master had emerged from the River Jordan in his baptism, and for 40 days and 40 nights was on the Mount of Temptation, there he learned and there he probed into the scriptures as to what was required of him. And there he learned the full import and the direction of his ministry. That prophecy starts with, Who hath believed our report? Thereafter he is informed as to what will be his destiny and how he was carrying out that ministry. He would be a lamb as led to the slaughter. He would be a sheep who would not utter his mouth. And then there's a long list of activities and conditions and sufferings that he would undergo, and also ends up with the glorious consummation of that hope and the wonderful arrangement and the wonderful consummation which says he shall be given a portion with the great and he shall divide it with the strong. And so it was in the strength of that the Master knew what was ahead of him when he came down from that mount. Paul, in looking back as well as to the destiny of the Master, in that second verse of the 12th chapter of Hebrews commented on earlier this morning, he was despised, that he would be despised of men. He knew that he would also have contradiction of sinners against himself. He also knew who hath believed our report. And we want to deal somewhat of public perception, because as had been already suggested, that we are surrounded, we're in the world, even though we try not to be of it. We are surrounded by influences and forces. We are molded by our environment. Our culture determines so much of how we respond and how we live, and often, unfortunately, our attitudes. And therefore, we need to always remember our separateness and our apartness. That while we are in the world, and we don't want to be isolated from the world, but we want to be insulated from the world. And that insulation from the world is this new creature life that we have. But so much a part of the influences that test and try and control sometimes the activities of the flesh is public perception about what we are and who we are. And the Master certainly experienced that. Who hath believed our report? You know, to that society, to those Jews that were assembled throughout Samaria, Judea, and Jerusalem, they found Jesus as a great enigma. He was a riddle. He was a puzzle. They couldn't figure him out. There was no question about his uniqueness. They knew that his message was different. He spoke not as the Pharisees. He spoke as one who had authority. And he had those wonderful words of life. And they were so stimulating. His works were miraculous. They were wonderful. Never before had there been such a demonstration of divine power. Yet, they couldn't quite understand what he was about. How do you explain him? How do you get any consistency from the man? He had so much strength. He was able to chase the money changers out of the temple. Yet he was so tender, so generous, and so feeling towards children. He was able to rebuke the highest of levels of authority in the kingdom, in the Jewish arrangement. And yet he was so tender and compassionate and was friend of sinners, and would frequent those who were the downcast and those who were, quote, sinners, end quotes. They couldn't quite get add up. What was his mission? What was his goal? Where was he going? And therefore, they saw him as perhaps a revolutionary, a radical, a mystic, a madman, a charlatan, a rabble-rouser, depending on which strata of society that was being asked. And certainly to the hierarchy, to the power structure, he was a most dangerous man. He was one that had to be watched. He was one who could be a seditionist. He could upset the status quo. And we need to make sure that that not happen. And therefore, who has believed our report? It depends upon really who you ask. Because the reception of his report is so different according to the intellectual and the cardiological and religious composition of each and every person. And therefore, as he went about his ministry, and as he went about preaching, doing good, we find that the common people heard him gladly. We find that they saw in him one who was interested in their needs and their welfare. They saw in him perhaps a reformer who could perhaps change the existing order of things and to root out corruption and hopefully maybe overthrow the Roman yoke. Oh, they must have had so much hope and expectation of this miracle worker. Then there were the zealots. These were the political actionists. These were the radicals. They did not believe in negotiations or the process of change. Rather, they were going to force the change. And they were waging a kind of guerrilla warfare against Roman yoke. And they were hoping, perhaps, that maybe now here we have an electrifying figure who can really catch the imagination of the people. Maybe he can be recruited for our objectives. Maybe he can really see that the way to get his ideals and the kind of order of things that he espouses through our method of overthrowing. And with all the miraculous power that he has, certainly he would be able to bring out a new order in a brief time. They perhaps perceived him in a quite a different sense. But then there was the political rulers, as we said. They were watching. And the established hierarchy. And you know, the hierarchy is not always the one who is in political power, but in this arrangement, it was those who were in the religious power. They had most to lose. They were the vested interests. They were upholding what they thought was a 2,000-year tradition of faith, and they were upholding God in God's arrangement through Moses. So they had a sense of prophetic zeal, and therefore they were going to view this man who was overthrowing tradition with a great deal of suspicion. But though Jesus centered his services and activities primarily, almost exclusively, upon the religious community. It was the religious community that he was appealing to, because in accordance with that prophetic vision and that prophetic mandate in Isaiah 53, he was to address, you know, this purpose of God's arrangement, and he was to give himself in this sacrifice for the welfare and needs of the world of mankind, and knew that there would be in the process the selection of a strong, that they would become a body of those who are strong, that he would be dividing a portion with the great, that he would then be able to have a body, his bride, that the God had ordained that there be a bridegroom and a bride, and that bride would be the mediator of a new world order. And therefore, he was seeking out to save those who were lost. He came to find out those of the lost sheep of the house of Israel. His intent was now to recruit those who were going to fit into the divine pattern which he had received from God. And that pattern was to find those who would be willing to follow his steps and be able to give in sacrifice as he was doing, and then thereby being able to carry out God's will for the greater purpose that he had in mind, so he would divide a portion with the great. And so he really leveled his ministry towards those who were, shall we say, of a religious, of a faith, who had the faith of Abraham as a foundation for this new arrangement that God was now instituting, not only for the deliverance of natural Israel, but for the deliverance of the whole world. And that was his searching, seeking to save that which was lost. And therefore, he confined not to the Samaritans, not to the heathen, but confined to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, his services and his time and his resources. It's interesting, and we're going to take a little time to just recount how he was perceived in that mission, how he did give his message, and how he carried out his mandate, and yet the impact it had on his audience. And we find it as varied as humankind. You know, humans are so unique and individual, and that's what's so wonderful in God's arrangement, that each one processes, if you please, what information, what impulses, what activities they are at the moment subjected to. And in the processing of it all, as human beings do this cranium and brain of ours, they then respond and react through a nervous system which is sometimes very defective. And then that determines the response to whatever situation they find. And everyone reacts in terms of their own needs, in terms of their own expectations, in terms of their own understanding. And it all gets somehow mixed together in their thinking process, in their emotional feelings, in their conscious subconsciousness, and it all then spews out in either verbal or physical behavioral responses. And that is the way, really, those people to whom Jesus' words were given. Now, in his efforts to recruit and to find those with whom he was looking, those who had the faith of Abraham, and that was really his prime concern. But, you know, in giving out that message, he spread it abroad to all who would hear, who had a hearing ear, and they in turn would then process and then respond. And so in his recruitment, he would spread the seeds of truth near and far. And as that parable in the 13th chapter of Matthew tells us about the good seed, where it falls, and it falls into all kinds of grounds, hard ground, shallow ground, and perchance there are some seeds that fall into good ground. And there is what he was looking for. And he knew that his Father was going to give him the core of that class, which would be his bride, that he would give him those whom God had selected. Jesus did not do the selecting. It was rather God that assured him of this. And we see how Jesus did work in that process, of how one by one, Peter, Andrew, John, James, and Nathaniel, we find one by one, there was something about that message. There was a ring to it that attracted them. And the Master, even in the case of Nathaniel, behold, an Israelite indeed, saw in that man that was coming a faith that was good soil. A faith that would really take the message that he had. And thus, he was going about preaching, looking for that good soil for the seed. And who has believed our report? We should just read a little bit, going through the account of John, of some of the reaction that he got as he did his work and as he preached his words. You remember that we might divide the ministry of our master into two basic periods. Oh, there are many that we might do so. But the first part, maybe the first year and a half, the first year and a quarter, was the period in which he was popular, in which he was able to demonstrate by his miracles, by his teachings. It was an electrifying message. You couldn't help but be bound by it. It was so beautiful, so feeling, so much appealing to the heart and to the mind, that they were only eager to hear. But then, as they received that message, and that was reinforced by some of the miracles that accompanied it, turning water into wine, feeding 5,000, walking on waters, healing the blind, all sorts of illnesses being cured. Oh, what a demonstration that they were drawn to. And how he was a man, he was the man of the hour. And how he was on everybody's tongue. But you know, as then he began to demonstrate his message and began to expect from them a response, and as his message became more of a cutting message, they withdrew, and as they did so, they reacted. Who has believed our report? In this sixth chapter of the book of John, after feeding the 5,000, and remember how they were traipsing around the lake trying to find him, and then they found him and they asked, well, now, Master, we are eager for you, words that effect. Then Jesus begins to really move into the heart. Jesus answered them and said, verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat bread of the loaves and were filled. In other words, you're not the disciples I'm looking for. You are the loaves and the fish disciples. I'm looking for those who are responding to me, not for what I can give them materially, but what I have for them spiritually and for their eternal welfare and for their eternal destiny. And when he began to speak in those terms, I'm sure some of them were somewhat drawn back, maybe defensive, and maybe felt that maybe perhaps he was a little too severe in his judgment. But then the master, now I'm just going to be just selectively from the 6th to the 10th chapter of John, just picking out points, just illustrating how they reacted. Jesus said to them, this is the work of God, that ye believe on him whom he has sent. And they said unto him, what sign showest thou then, that we may see and believe thee? What dost thou work? Tell us, really, come out with it. Tell us what you really are all about. What sign, where is your mission? The master, you know, just answers their questions. And it's beautiful as you go through that book of John and also any of the other Gospels, to see the interchange, question, answer, response. You know, the questions that were asked were questions, and the master answered every single one of those questions. Now, those questions were not understood. The answers, I should say, were not understood. Jesus gave them the answers, but Jesus knew as well that they couldn't understand it, because these things were to be spiritually enlightening. And without the Spirit, they could not really grasp what he was saying. He said that to Nicodemus, you remember. Nicodemus came to him, and Nicodemus asked him, about his ministry and about being, you know, and Jesus says you must be begotten again. And he says, well, how can this be? How is it possible for a man to enter his mother's womb the second time? And Jesus said, are you a leader of Israel and you don't know the basics? How can you know spiritual things? And it was true. It was not for them yet. It was at a time at Pentecost when the Spirit then came of enlightenment. But the point was that he gave these answers. And while even the disciples couldn't understand it, and you remember as you go through the latter days of our Master's life, how he was so concerned about those dear 12, how they were going to fare when he was not on the scene because they would be like scattered sheep. But he knew that he was giving them, he had told them these truths. And he said, when he, the Comforter, shall come, he shall tell you all of these things, and your sadness, your sorrow will be turned to joy. And then afterwards they perceived and they remembered. You see, it was. Jesus answered every one of those questions that were posed by the crowds and the Pharisees and the lawyers and the scribes. Everyone precisely. They could not understand it because they were thinking in human terms and he had answered in spiritual realities. And therefore, he waited there knowing that those who had the faith of Abraham. And he says to them, if you cannot believe what I say, well, believe for the very work's sake. Believe that only one who can do these things, these miracles, only one could do it by the power of God. And I'm telling you what that power is and what that word says. And if you had the faith of Abraham, you would say that God is going to manifest this in his own due time, just as Abraham went by faith. So now you, if you are really of the quality that I'm seeking, you are going to have that faith and wait upon God to reveal it and to show it unto you. That was his mission. That was his method. And those who did have such a firm faith and who were alert enough to recognize that in these works this was a sign of messiahship also had the love and the patience and the faith to wait for God's evidence and manifestation and revealment. And thus, well, I see at times this flies. We see that, let me read just some selected portions. Then we read how, and I can't give you the specifics, in John 6:59, he taught in Capernaum, and he gave that preaching about blood and the body. They asked him about this, give us this bread, and he said, I am the bread of life, and it's not except of my broken body, and unless you drink of my blood, you have no life in you. And they thought he was talking about cannibalism, and they raised the question, how can this thing be? And then the account reads, and from that time many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. And then Jesus says to the 12, will ye also go away? There, you see, was the acid test. There, if you had the faith of Abraham, you would not depart with those others, but rather Peter then blessed his heart. Oh, that dear Peter, impulsive though he was, and a man of strength and yet of limitations and weaknesses, bless his heart, he says, Master, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life, and we believe and are sure that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's what he was looking for and seeking. But the masses, after which it says, the Jews sought to kill him in John 7:1. In John 7:12, and there was much murmuring amongst the people. Some said, he's a good man. Others say, nay, he deceives the people. Howbeit, no Jews spoke openly of him for fear of, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Now, the Jews marvel, saying, how knoweth this man letters, having never learned? And then they said, did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you keeps the law? Why go ye about killing me? And the people answered and said, thou hast the devil,
who has gone about killing thee? And then the Pharisees come, heard the people murmuring such things concerning him, and the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. The people heard these same, indeed he is a prophet. Others said, this is Christ. And then others said, there was so much division in 743 that some tried to apprehend him. And then these very officers that were sent out from the Sanhedrin came back empty-handed. And the priest said to them, why haven't you brought him? And the officers answered and said, never hath the man spake like this. They were so captivated by what he was saying that they could not apprehend him and seize him. Of course, his time had not yet come. And none of the hosts of the demons could possibly have apprehended him. No man, no army, no cadet corps could possibly have done that because his time had not yet come. But as we can leapfrog over some of the other reactions, I think Bullinger, in one of his comments, just summarizes the answer to the question, what think ye of Christ? That's really, you know, putting the same question in another form. Who hath believed our report? What think ye of Christ? And he gives a citation, and he just gives us the variety of responses. Some said he's the king of the Jews. These were the wise men of the East. John the Baptist said he's mightier than I. The demon said he's the son of God. Certain scribes called him a blasphemer. The two blind men and the woman of Canaan called him a son of David. He was called the carpenter's son by his fellow countrymen. He was called John the Baptist by Herod and others. Others called him Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets. Peter called him the son of the living God. Martha called him the Christ, the son of God. A certain ruler called him a good master. The multitude called him the prophet of Nazareth. Many heard him say, or said that he was the carpenter, the son of Mary. All in the synagogue said he was Joseph's son. Others witnessing the raising of the widow's son said, he's a great prophet. Roman centurion saw him as a righteous man. The two going to Emmaus saw him as a prophet mighty in deed and word. John the Baptist, the Lamb of God. Andrew the Messiah, the Son of God, the King of Israel by Nathanael. Nicodemus saw him as a teacher come from God. The woman of Samaria saw him as a prophet. And then the blind man saw him as a prophet. You see, there was so much confusion as to really the role of this man. And really, how do you explain these inconceivable set of circumstances surrounding this individual's life? Well, you know, this is public opinion. This is a kind of a consensus of what people respond to after they process what they experience. And, you know, public opinion is such an important factor in our own cultural life because what is thought of around us influences us greatly. And as we consider public opinion, we realize how much we are influenced by it. Let us not ever think that we can be so insulated from it that it does not have its impact upon us. And we need to be very much concerned and very much aware of how much rubs off on us without our even knowing it. Oftentimes, some of the prejudices, some of the feelings, some of our partisanship comes from these influences that we feel that we should be more objective about, but yet they touch the flesh. And as they do that, they really influence perhaps some of our spiritual responses. You know, the molder of public opinion is really the adversary. Because, you know, the adversary has only one method by which he is being able to be so effective, and that is the method of deception. You know, at the end of the millennial reign of Christ, when that little season is on, you know, in happening, the account says that when that Satan is let loose, that he goes forth to deceive the nations. He's not going to go there, you know, with any show of force, but rather by these subtleties and by these sophistries and by the intellectual machinations. Perhaps he will be able to tempt more than we think and to make them somewhat rebellious against the arrangement that God has manifested unto them for 1,000 years to be the way of life and of happiness. And that great deceiver is very much on the scene because he knows that his days are numbered and limited. And as has been said earlier, that this is the most perilous of times of history. In the last days, perilous times shall come. And the adversary is a great master deceiver. And he's deceiving through every possible way, through propaganda, through education, and through the media. You know, we are today talking about education as being such a critical national priority. And it's true that it ought to be when you consider the learning of some of our young people. But you know, the adversary is an educator too. He's not worried about the methods of teaching and training of the illiterate. Rather, he's teaching and he's concerned about the curriculum. And he has his own curriculum. And he has, during the Dark Ages, recognized that the world is in such ignorance that in fact, there was no such thing as, public education or education for only perhaps a minor fraction of the smallest minority. But now, you see, with the Enlightenment, and with all the interchange of information, that now he has captured that information for his own nefarious purposes. He has changed the curriculum now to such a way in which popularity takes the place of principle, where competence is more important than character, where tolerance is the byword instead of truth. He is changing as never before, darkness for light, light for darkness. And in that manipulation, in that manner in which he is controlling the intellectual content, he is turning out more educated fools with this generation than ever before. I say fools, but I'm not being derogatory, I'm being scriptural. The scripture says that the fool saith in his heart, there is no God. And certainly the curriculum that the adversary has imposed from the little kindergarten up instills that very thing. There is no God, and therefore the PhDs are all spoiled with that idea, there is no God. Most educated generation of fools in all of history. The adversary is deceived. The adversary is well achieved that goal. And so as we see the media, it's just permeated with filth, garbage. How it is just being dumped upon the American people in every way, through every source. Minds are being so polluted. That is the atmosphere. That molds public opinion. This is what we are living in. And in that kind of context, we now are trying to do what the Master did, putting out our little word of truth, trying to attract, as he did, those who have the faith, those who would respond to the message of hope, to a scriptural presentation of the character of God, and oppose a divine plan of the ages. But the public opinion, the pollution of the normal moral and mental atmosphere is so pervasive that who has believed our report? While we still have the opportunity, dear friends, to spread this word, we are to take every, seize it with eagerness, realizing that In the West, I think the opportunities are narrowing. I subscribe to the idea that now most of the work of the harvest has been done in the America and in the Western cultures. And the tail end of the harvest work, I believe, would be done primarily by perhaps those nations, those countries, those lands, those people who never had the blessings that this country has so, for over 100 years, so abundantly had and used. But now they will be able to allow in their own native lands. They now have the technology, the means whereby they can then serve their own peoples in these waning days with this glorious message of hope. But then we are to do with our might what our hands find to do. But I think in our attitudes, we are to make certain that we do not reflect some of the prejudices and some of the feelings that we see all about us. That is, for example, regarding our message of the collapse of the present evil order. We are still to put forth that as a very strong part of our faith. We are to oppose, perhaps, this concept of globalization as they are now trying to affect it, because we know that the next global empire is going to be the fifth universal empire, and that's not going to be under President Clinton. It's going to be under the Christ head and body. We are to let the world know of our opposition to violence, to war, what we stand for. To uphold a banner of morality, be able to make certain that others know that we are standing apart and are separate from. We are to let them know that the Jubilee has sounded, that the time has come now for a new change in order. It may sound revolutionary to some, but under today's society, everybody seems to have doing their own thing, and therefore it's not that critical for them. We ought to tell them that the time to favor Israel has come, and that we ought to have sympathy for the Jews and for their future. And sometimes some of our brethren are tainted, unconsciously perhaps, with a little feeling of, well, maybe, a little touch of what we might call anti-Semitism. It's the flesh, to be sure. But the new creature's got to be aware of it. And not be a party to any of the little innuendos, jokes, or little sly remarks, or any physical evidence of disdain or disapproval. We are to stand for the unpopular Bible teachings. Stand against such doctrines as Trinity and all of these deceptions of the demons perpetrated upon man. Stand against them, even though you are being labeled, and even though the evangelicals have got us pegged and who are very much adamant, and yet don't even call us Christians. Well, I see our chairman is here. The question is being asked of us. What think ye of Christ? The question being asked of our neighbors, of our family, by our co-workers, by all those with whom we come in contact, questions being asked of them, what do you think of Christ? Now, they don't know Christ, but you, they do know. And you ought to be Christ in the flesh. Don't we believe that? Don't we believe when we participate in the memorial service that we're identified with the body of Christ? Didn't Paul tell us that we are ambassadors for Christ? Didn't we learn that we are members of his church? And as such, we represent him. What kind of representation do we have? What is the public opinion about us? What do they see in us? Who has believed our report? Well, not very many. But your life is speaking even more loudly than your words. What do they see in you and in me? How do they perceive our lives? We hope that we are influencing public opinion rather than public opinion influencing us. and determining our reaction. Let us be more aware of all these insidious forces and ideas and philosophies and sophistries that are just swirling about us, their practices and their methods. Let us be more aware, perceptive, so that we will be living examples of what it means to live the Christ life. That if now they cannot see what thinking of Christ in the future, in the kingdom, when they look back, they'll be able, in the day of their visitation, to say, yes, there was a Christian. There was my brother, my sister, my co-worker, whoever. They were living a Christ life, and I didn't see it. I trust their friends. That will be our insulation from the world, not isolation. May God add his blessing.
Thank you very much, Brother Ray Luke, and we have been blessed as a result of Brother Ray's service here, and I'm sure that all of us will endeavor to make our lives an example of those who have believed.